Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Chesrich, and I'm very happy to welcome to our radio station Stephen Kinzer. Stephen Kinzer is a veteran journalist who covered foreign affairs for the New York Times. He's now a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. He writes a column for the Boston Globe, and he is the author of a number of books, including The True Flag and The Brothers. His latest book, and what we will be in conversation about, is called Poisoner in Chief: Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA's Search for Mind Control. Stephen Kinzer, it is, as I was saying, my very good pleasure to welcome you back to this radio station. Thank you for being here.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you. We interviewed you many years ago about another book that you wrote called The Brothers, which was about the Dulles brothers and what they were doing, I guess, in the 1950s with the CIA and the State Department and sort of U.S. interest overseas. Does this story about Sidney Gottlieb come from there?
Yes. Yeah. That's a very trenchant observation. So this is my 10th book, and I've devoted myself over my career to trying to figure out a little bit of what goes on behind the facade of the public politics and public diplomacy that we see. I've discovered in the course of that research a lot of things that are surprising, and they may have shocked some people. But this is the first time I've been shocked. I still cannot believe what I found in researching this book. I cannot believe this MK Ultra program existed, and I can't believe that this unknown figure who I've now uncovered, Sidney Gottlieb, who ran that program, really lived. So how did I get to this story? Because Sidney Gottlieb lived in total invisibility. Even at the CIA, almost nobody knew what he did. While I was researching this book, by coincidence, I met a guy who was the former director of the CIA, and I told him, I'm writing a biography of Sidney Gottlieb. Yeah. And he looked at me blankly and said, I never heard of him. And I believe him. So, Sidney Gottlieb was the chief chemist at the CIA, but of course, one of the most secret figures. I really think I discovered the most powerful unknown American of the 20th century, unless there was somebody else who lived in complete invisibility, carried out grotesque experiments on human subjects across three continents, and had what amounted to a license to kill issued by the U.S. government. So when I was writing that book about the Dulles brothers, I included in a page or two a story about a CIA officer who brought poison to the Congo to be used in killing the Prime Minister of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba. That was in the summer of 1960. So I kind of filed that one away and did the rest of the book, but it never left my mind. I kept asking myself, wait a minute, a U.S. government employee carried government-made poison from Washington to a foreign country with the purpose of assassinating the leader of that country with poison. So who was this guy? Was it a courier? Slowly I discovered, no, it was not a courier. It was a person who was the chief chemist of the CIA, and his name was Sidney Gottlieb. Then I came to realize that it was the same Sidney Gottlieb who made all the poisons to kill Fidel Castro, including poison cigars and a poison wetsuit and poison pills. That was all him. So I began to realize that this guy really was America's poisoner in chief, as I call my book. But then I began researching his life and career more deeply, and I realized that making poisons to kill foreign leaders was just a sidelight for him. That was nothing. He was just the pharmacist in that project. MK Ultra, which was the CIA search for mind control, is a much bigger story than that. And this is what I delved into and what has really blown my mind, if I can use that expression, in doing this new book project.
I want to get into all that. Quickly, though, what happened with the attempt to assassinate Patrice Lumumba?
So Gottlieb arrived in the Congo and brought the poison kit. Not just a vial of poison, but an entire kit with a hypodermic syringe and all the accoutrements to the CIA station chief in the Congo. And he told him, your job is to use this to assassinate Prime Minister Lumumba. By his own account in his memoir, the station chief replied, Jesus H. Christ, who authorized this operation? And Gottlieb replied, President Eisenhower. So the station chief took the poison, but the Belgians, who had their entire national financial wealth tied up in the Congo, got to Lumumba first. His passion for nationalism and for taking over European mineral concessions in his country marked him for death. So he was executed by a squad of Belgian and Congolese armed men before the poison could be used. Wow. Nonetheless, the fact that Gottlieb had produced this poison after having just produced a series to kill Castro secured his reputation as poisoner-in-chief at the CIA.
So he was assassinated before he got to him. I think people are familiar, have heard about the cigars, the poison cigars for Fidel Castro.
Yeah, so one of the things that happened in that Castro project is that right after President Eisenhower gave the order that Castro should be sawed off, as he put it, in May of 1960, the CIA sent an emissary, famously, to meet with two famous mafia gangsters in Las Vegas and tell them, we want to hire one of your killers to gun down Fidel Castro in Havana. And they essentially told him, you've been watching too many movies. That's not a good idea. The shooter would never be able to escape. But you must have somebody at the CIA who makes poison, and we could get people close to Castro. Well, they had never heard the name Sidney Gottlieb. Nobody had. But they were right. Yes, there was someone at the CIA who made poison. So one of his first projects was to obtain a box of 50 Cohiba cigars that was Castro's favorite brand, and painstakingly taint each one of them with botulinum, which was one of his favorite poisons. It was so potent that you wouldn't even have to smoke the cigar. You just have to put it in your mouth and you would die. Obviously, those cigars never got to Castro. Then Gottlieb was charged with making packets of L pills. So in researching this book, I've learned a little lexicon that
you got the lingo.
So an L stands for lethal. So those are pills to kill people. And he did make packets of L pills for Castro, and they were sent to Cuba, but obviously never got their way into Castro's tea. Gottlieb even created a wetsuit that was supposed to be given to Castro as a gift, and it was poisoned inside with a fungus that would eat away Castro's skin and kill him once he put it on. So his imagination was fantastic. When Gottlieb was asked to come up with an experiment or a drug or a pill or a way to kill, he had an infinite variety of options.
Was he ever successful? And we'll get to the other things about torture and things, but was he ever successful in taking down a world leader?
He was not successful in taking down a head of state. We do believe, however, that he's responsible for several assassinations, including that of an Iraqi colonel who the U.S. had identified as a communist or a dangerous person. And by his later admission, he told this to his lawyer in later years after he retired, at the request of the CIA that wanted to find a way to get this colonel sawed off, Gottlieb made a scarf that was tainted with tuberculosis. And this scarf got to that colonel, and sure enough, he died very shortly thereafter. So as far as we know, he didn't succeed in killing heads of state, but he killed plenty of other people.
Well, that's very interesting to think about our involvement in Iraq. Obviously, when we think about our relationship to Iraq, it's usually 1991 on.
Absolutely. And one of the fascinating aspects of looking at the early period of the CIA is that you see there the seeds of so much turmoil and upheaval that they created, or they set the stage for, that didn't really mature until years later.
So these years that we're going to be really talking about is the 1950s and 60s. Again, this does correspond with the period of the Dulles brothers. What's important to know about this period of time in telling this story?
I think the most important thing is to realize that Americans were placed into a state of absolute panic during the period of the early Cold War. We were told and made to believe that we had a heinous, horrific enemy determined not only to destroy our country, but to wipe out the possibility of any meaningful human life on Earth. We were told that the Soviet communists could either attack us without warning with a nuclear weapon and liquidate our nation in a matter of minutes, or send troops to conquer Europe and be at the English Channel in 48 hours, or even perhaps scariest of all, slowly subvert all the countries around us until we were the only one left and had to surrender. In this climate, everything seems justifiable. And I do believe this is one of the messages that the Gottlieb period has for today. During the early 50s, Americans were told that although we are a very ethical and innocent and just country, there come certain moments that are so extreme when we have to put aside our morals and ethics and very temporarily do things that we wouldn't do under normal circumstances because we're essentially so good. Now, again, we're in a period where we're told that because of extreme threats that we face, we can't enjoy the civil liberties that we used to have. We have to carry out operations that normally would be repugnant to us. So I think there's always this danger. The greatest justification for committing immoral acts is commitment to a great cause. Patriotism is among the most transcendent and seductive of causes. And in that environment, it's perhaps understandable to see how a gentle-hearted chemist who thought of himself as a compassionate humanist could become America's most prolific torturer.
He thought he was doing it for the cause.
Absolutely. Gottlieb had been turned down for military service in World War II because of his club foot. He couldn't walk straight. And this weighed on him. He felt he wanted to serve his country in some other way.
Because that's what people were doing right after Pearl Harbor.
Absolutely.
Very much like we saw after 9/11.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the fact that he couldn't serve was a burden to him when he had a chance, when he was called by the CIA, for whom he went to work in 1951 on a Friday the 13th, I noticed, he was willing to give his all.
And he was a chemist. He had a PhD in chemistry?
That's right. So Sidney Gottlieb, who was brought into the CIA in 1951, was very different from the kind of people who populated the early CIA. Most of them were silver spoon aristocrats who knew each other from prep schools and investment banks and private clubs. Gottlieb was totally different from this. He was the son of Jewish immigrants. He grew up in the Bronx. He went to City College of New York. He came out to California to go to Caltech, where he got his PhD. So in his background, he was completely different from the kind of people that he worked with. He stuttered, he limped, he was young, he was Jewish, he came from New York City, from an immigrant family. But he was also different in another extraordinary way, probably different from any federal civil servant in the early 1950s. He was a kind of a proto-hippie. He lived on the land. He had an eco-cabin with no running water. He meditated. He studied Buddhism. He grew his own vegetables. He got up before dawn to milk his goats to make yogurt. So he was certainly the most gentle-hearted torturer America has ever produced.
His wife, too, sort of a proto cultural warrior.
It's true.
Countercultural warrior.
The two of them were spiritual seekers. So he had grown up in an Orthodox Jewish household, had a bar mitzvah. She was the daughter of a Presbyterian preacher, a missionary. She'd been born in India and brought up in a missions center. Both of them became estranged from their religious roots, and were looking for something different in life. And it's such an odd fit that a person who felt himself so deeply spiritual and humanistic would, during the day, be directing this MK Ultra project, which led him to conduct the most extreme experiments on human beings that have ever been conducted by any agent or agency of the U.S. government.
I mean, this is begging me to ask what those are, and we are going to get into those. But quickly, were you able to find accounts from people who knew him, who knew he even did that, or would they have never even known?
It's certain that while he was at the peak at MK Ultra, very, very few people knew what he was doing.
Did his wife know?
I believe his wife did know, yes. And I'll tell you one story. So you said, did I come up with interviews? Yeah, I naturally, in the course of this book, looked for people that had contact with Gottlieb in any way. And I did find a few CIA officers and people who had worked with him in later positions, nobody that worked with him at MK Ultra. But here's one really interesting source that I found. I located a woman who had been, in the 1950s, the 16-year-old girlfriend of one of Gottlieb's kids. This meant she spent a lot of time in the Gottlieb home. This was a fantastic find for me because she was able to tell me so much about how they lived and what an interesting environment it was. They talked about things that were never talked about at my dinner table. They had so many books. The whole environment was so fascinating. And then she told me the story. One day I was home alone with Peter. The family was out shopping. And Peter took me into his father's study, and he told me, turn around. So I turned around, and he did something, which I didn't see. And when I turned back around, the bookshelf was opening up on the wall. It was sliding open. And behind the bookshelf was a gun rack, and there were a whole series of firearms back there. And I said to Peter, what is that? And he said, my father kills people. And I said to him, is he in the mafia? And Peter said, no, he's in the CIA. So later on, he told her never to reveal that he had told her these things or that he'd shown her the gun rack. And I asked her, why do you think that he had guns in his house? And she said, probably they were afraid that somebody who had figured out that he or she was one of Gottlieb's victims or some friend of theirs might have come after him. Or maybe somebody that worked for one of those foreign leaders that he tried to kill would come after him. And he wanted to be ready to defend himself. But she did add, this episode, now that I think about it, makes me believe that all four of the kids knew exactly what the father did, and that the mother did as well. In fact, in one of his later depositions, Gottlieb was asked, did you ever speak to anyone about your MK Ultra work? And he replied, I talked to my wife quite a bit.
Interesting. This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Stephen Kinzer. Stephen Kinzer is the author of the book Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. That is what we are in conversation about. Okay, let's get into MK Ultra. This is going to be fun, I think. But before it was known as MK Ultra, it was known as Bluebird.
The project to find the key to mind control, run by the CIA, started out being called Bluebird, then the name was changed to Artichoke, and finally...
Artichoke.
Supposedly it was Alan Dulles' favorite vegetable. and later it became MK Ultra. I think Alan Dulles chose that name very consciously because for him, this was the Ultra project. If you could find a way for the CIA to control people's minds... nothing less than global mastery would be the prize. Other CIA successes of the early 1950s, like overthrowing the government of Guatemala or overthrowing the government of Iran, would pale into insignificance if the CIA could find a way to control minds. And that was the goal of MK Ultra.
And MK stands for mind
MK control. Is a CIA diptych that just means a project that has worldwide scope. It's not regionally limited.
Okay, so it's not mind control with the K.
That's a great idea, though. Maybe it was in the Alan Dulles cerebrum. Who knows?
This begins, though, at least in the Bluebird phase of it, before Sidney Gottlieb gets there?
It's true. The CIA began this search in a sort of disjointed way, even before Gottlieb arrived. And it was the disjointed nature of the search that ultimately led Alan Dulles to decide, we need somebody who can put this all together and administer it as a single project, a one-stop, self-contained global entity. So the early originators of MK Ultra and Gottlieb fit into this group. first ask themselves these questions. If our goal is to find a way to insert a new mind into somebody's brain, how would we go about that? Well, the first thing you'd have to do is destroy the mind that's already in there. So there would be a void. How do we do that? Well, with the mind of a scientist, Gottlieb and the people around him figured out we have to first go to the places where research on this subject has already been done. We need to pick up where whoever else is out there has left off. So they looked around and tried to find people, chemists, physicians, and other scientists who were experts in figuring out ways to destroy a human mind and a human spirit and a human body. Well, the obvious first place to look was in the Nazi concentration camps and their counterparts in Japan. So the early CIA mind control program was built as an extension of experiments that had begun in Nazi concentration camps.
They had the documents from the Nazi doctors?
Not only do we have the documents, the doctors themselves were hired to come to work for the CIA. The most notorious example, which is the story with which I begin my book, is Kurt Blume, who was the chief of the Nazi biowarfare program. He was the chief experimenter with poisons and toxins and bioweapons. Kurt Blume was a defendant at the Nuremberg doctor's trial, where several of the defendants were sentenced to death. Before the verdicts were announced, the CIA got to the judges, who were all American military officers, and told them, essentially, we don't want to hang Kurt Blume, we want to hire him. And so, on the basis of what Nazi doctors and their Japanese counterparts had begun during the Second World War in experiments that resulted in the excruciating murder of countless people, was built the CIA mind control program.
Was it solid science? If we could just for a second put the morality of it to the side.
It was solid science in a narrower sense, but not in a larger sense. For example, two of the first Nazi doctors or scientists who came to brief Gottlieb's people at his base in Fort Detrick in Maryland were former employees at concentration camps who had experimented with sarin, which is a highly toxic gas. So they gave a lecture, the notes of which I found, in which they described how sarin works. And they talked in detail about how long it takes to die from sarin at different levels of density of the poison, which means they must have had to experiment on many people. And I even noticed a little aside in one of their talks in which one of these scientists said, the age of the subject does not seem to matter in the amount of sarin that is necessary to produce death. So that means they must have had to kill children to find out if it worked the same way. So these were things the CIA couldn't do itself, so it was very happy to have scientists come and tell them these things. So it was science in that sense, but in a larger sense, it was complete fantasy because the whole idea of mind control, as Gottlieb himself was forced to admit after 10 years of laying waste to human lives, is a myth. Yeah. It was made up, and the CIA actually created the idea of brainwashing through one of its own propagandists who invented the word. And then the CIA fell for its own fantasy and believed that things they'd read about in Edgar Allan Poe stories and Sherlock Holmes stories and seen in movies like Gaslight and movies about Svengalis who could make people go out and kill was real. And they thought that what fiction writers could imagine, science could create. That was the great miscalculation that led to the devastation of MKUltra.
Yeah, mind control has always been a fantasy. and
it's okay to be a fantasy, but it's always dangerous to confuse fantasy with reality. And in fact, one odd aspect of MKUltra is that as it became known beginning in the late 1970s, it nurtured a whole new genre of books and movies that are all about wiping the mind clean or inserting something into someone's mind. All those Bourne Identity and Men in Black and Spotless Mind movies all come out of that. So it means that a government program that was nurtured by fiction actually wound up itself nurturing a whole new genre of fiction.
And neuroscientists today would say they don't even know what the mind even is.
For this book, I went to speak to several neuroscientists, and they told me what a crazy project this was. And indeed, several established and well-reputed psychologists who were consulted by the CIA told them this.
At the time.
The brothers who ran the famous Menninger Clinic in Kansas, who were probably the best-known psychologists in America at that time, both wrote, this is nonsense. This can't exist. But the CIA, like government and like many of us, is victim to what psychologists call confirmation bias. When you get evidence that supports your point of view, you take it very seriously. When you get evidence that contradicts your point of view, you just dismiss or ignore it. And I think that's what led the CIA off on this crazy search.
Why did the CIA want mind control capabilities? What was the long-term goal?
As the CIA saw it, this was purely a defensive project. So I mentioned earlier that their psyches had been nurtured as they grew up with all these stories about mind control, and that created something like a fertile ground. But then a couple of things happened in the early Cold War period that the CIA misinterpreted as meaning the communists have found the key to mind control. The first one was a trial of a Roman Catholic archbishop in Hungary. He was put on trial by communist authorities. He confessed to crimes that he obviously had not committed. He spoke in a monotone. He looked glazed. So the CIA watching this thought, he has been brainwashed. They've taken control of his mind. Now, later it turned out that he had been coerced with very normal methods like repeated interrogation and close confinement and beatings, the same things that torturers and interrogators have been doing for centuries. But the CIA couldn't believe that. To them, it was confirmation of this great chimera, this great illusion that was out there. Then, a few years later, at the end of the Korean War, American prisoners were released, and it turned out that a number of them had written statements criticizing aspects of life in the United States or had confessed to committing war crimes themselves, even using germ warfare, which the U.S. government firmly insisted it had never done. So the CIA had to come up with an explanation for how our strapping young men could have done these things. To say that they wrote statements criticizing American life because they felt that some things about American life were wrong is not possible. So it had to be, again, brainwashing. As a matter of fact, I found one of these memos that talks about this bizarre idea, and it has something very interesting in it. How did they get brainwashed? The CIA didn't have the answers to all this, but they did say that these prisoners had to take a train that took them from North Korea across China to where they were going to be released. And they said several of them reported going through an area where they seemed to feel strange. It seemed like a dead zone. And this was somewhere in Manchuria.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the Manchurian candidate.
It's the first time the word Manchuria was associated with mind control. And that gave birth to the whole phrase Manchurian candidate. So, in sum, the CIA decided that since the communists have come up with the tool of mind control, and since this tool can be the key to controlling the whole world, it's absolutely urgent that we do the same thing, and the sacrifice of a few lives or a few hundred lives would be nothing compared to the scope of the prize.
Was this all being driven by Sidney Gottlieb?
This is a very good question. So who was above Gottlieb? What was the project? Actually, it's amazing to see how little supervision Gottlieb had. He essentially had permission from the U.S. government to requisition human subjects in Europe and in East Asia and experiment them to death if he wanted to. But nobody was looking over his shoulder. Nobody knew what he was doing. And I think this was intentional. Only a couple of people at the CIA, probably Alan Dulles, who was the director, and his longtime deputy, Richard Helms, knew exactly or knew, had a very good idea of what Gottlieb was doing. Now, you might think that once they understand that a guy working for them is carrying out extreme experiments that are very bloody, that are horrifically brutal, that result in deaths, they might react by saying, I'd like to know a little bit more about these. But instead, their reaction was the opposite. The more brutal they understood these experiments to be, the less they wanted to know about them. This is obedience to a culture that I think reigns not just at the CIA, but probably in other secret services as well. Ignorance is an asset in many cases. You don't want to know too much, partly because you can always deny knowing things, but also, well, years later, you can always deny that you knew what was happening. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. When these people at the head of the CIA were questioned about Gottlieb, the answer always came out that, well, it was one crazy guy, and I guess we didn't supervise him well enough, which was exactly true, but the fact that they didn't supervise him was not an accident.
Wow. Where does LSD come into this story?
Gottlieb was fascinated with LSD. It was colorless, it was odorless, and it could produce such spectacular effects in such tiny quantities that he thought this could be the key to mind control.
Yeah, and LSD is created by Albert Hofmann.
That's right. Albert Hofmann was the chemist at the Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland who accidentally discovered LSD. Sidney Gottlieb became really the first acid visionary. He was the first LSD guru. He became so fixated on LSD that in 1953, he persuaded the CIA to spend $240,000 to buy the world's entire supply. He got it from that company in Switzerland, Sandoz, and he brought it to the United States. He used that unique storehouse of LSD in two ways. One was to fuel horrific experiments that ended up devastating people's lives. In the United States, these experiments were carried out mostly in prisons for obvious reasons. For example, there was one carried out at the federal penitentiary in Kentucky in which seven African-American inmates were segregated, put into a cell, and then without being told what was happening to them, were given triple doses of LSD every day for 77 days. This was part of Gottlieb's effort to see if such overdoses could destroy a human mind. And guess what? Yes.
It did.
They can. Abroad.
What happened to those seven guys?
We never found out what happened to those seven people. Those protocols were destroyed, and we don't even know their names. I suspect that they died without ever even understanding that they had been part of a CIA experiment. Abroad, Gottlieb's experiments were even more brutal because there he didn't have what they charmingly refer to as the disposal problem. You could get rid of the bodies. Nobody would notice. The subjects were what they called expendables. So those would be people who were suspected of being enemy agents, or refugees who just seemed lost and didn't have any connection to anybody. In East Asia, many of the victims were captured North Korean prisoners of war. And in these experiments, Gottlieb used not only LSD, but every kind of other drug and extreme technique he could imagine. For example, he carried out one experiment in Germany in which he deeply sedated his subjects, then injected them with massive overdoses of barbiturates to stimulate them. And while they were in the transition phase between coma and extreme hyperactivity, still locked in their sensory deprivation chambers, he would administer overdoses of electroshock to them to see if this would be a way to destroy a human mind and a human body. In the course of my research, I discovered what I think is the CIA's first secret prison. It's a lovely chateau in Germany. I took a picture of it that's in the book. And the guy
is
who
in Munich?
It's outside of Frankfurt. The guy who now owns it is a young German businessman. He's renovated it nicely and made apartments there. He took me into the basement, and he showed me the storerooms, and he said these were the cells where the CIA doctors and their Nazi colleagues carried out experiments that were just continuations of the experiments that had gone on in the concentration camps just down the road. And he also said to me, the older people who live around here tell me that they understood. Everyone knew after a while what was going on in this house. And they tell me that bodies were buried in forests around here in places that are now covered over with shopping malls and other kinds of developments. So that was the most coercive, the most horrific use of LSD. But Gottlieb also had another side to his LSD project, and that was the volunteer, non-coercive side. So he wanted to know how ordinary people would react to LSD in a clinical setting. Since the CIA does not offer clinical settings itself, he subcontracted these experiments. And the way he did it was to create a couple of bogus medical foundations that contacted clinics and hospitals and universities around the whole United States and told them, we have money for you. We want to pay you to call for volunteers, and you give them this psychoactive substance, which we will provide, and all you have to do is write down reports on their reactions. So almost overnight, a new market grew up for these experiments. The clinics, in most cases, I think, had no idea that these foundations were actually just conduits for the CIA, or that their experiments were being conducted as part of a mind control search directed by Sidney Gottlieb, who, of course, nobody had heard of. So, who were among the very first people who came in to volunteer to take LSD that actually came from Sidney Gottlieb's stash, although they didn't know this? One of the first was Ken Kesey.
Really?
He took it at the VA hospital in Menlo Park. He loved it. So much so that he actually got a job in the hospital. And that gave him the material that he used to write his famous
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
But I found out in my research that was just a benefit that he discovered afterward. He really took the job for another reason. He wanted to steal the LSD out of the medicine chest and bring it home to his friends, which is what he did. At Stanford, one of the first people to volunteer to take LSD was the poet Allen Ginsberg.
And this was the same LSD?
This was Sidney Gottlieb's LSD. Another one was Robert Hunter, the lyricist for the Grateful Dead, who was the first Grateful Dead person to take LSD. So all of these people thought LSD was great. They told their friends to go in and volunteer. And the next thing you know, LSD had leaked out of the laboratories and the clinics into mass society. It makes Gottlieb essentially an unwitting godfather of the whole 60s counterculture. And decades later, these people came to understand that. John Lennon was asked in an interview about LSD, and he said, we must always remember to thank the CIA.
Wow.
If he had known more, if he had known what's in my book, he would have said, we must always remember to thank Sidney Gottlieb. This is the guy who turned on the Grateful Dead, turned on Ken Kesey, turned on Allen Ginsberg, and through them fueled a generational rebellion. And, of course, the irony is that the drug that Gottlieb hoped would give the CIA the tool to control people's minds wound up fueling a whole movement that was aimed at destroying everything the CIA believes in.
That's fascinating. We are in conversation with Stephen Kinzer. Stephen Kinzer is longtime foreign affairs journalist, also columnist, and senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. You can find his columns in the Boston Globe. The name of his book that we're in conversation about is called Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. So Sidney Gottlieb would retire from the CIA. We're going to leap forward a little bit here. Go into a world of volunteering and charitable work. And I'm even going to skip over that a little bit because I'm very interested about how Congress finally learns about Sidney Gottlieb and reaches out to him.
So after retiring in 1973 with Richard Helms, Gottlieb and Helms decided they had to destroy all the records of MKUltra, which they did on the way out.
They destroyed all that.
Gottlieb then went on to become the Sidney Gottlieb that he always thought he was, the deeply compassionate human being who only cares about helping the suffering in the world. So he and his wife sold all their belongings and their cabin, and they got on a freighter in San Francisco and traveled off to Asia and began volunteering in places where they could be of service. In the summer of 1975, they were working at a hospital for leprosy patients in India when Sidney Gottlieb heard from the general counsel to the CIA with a most unwelcome message. And the message essentially was, we have bad news for you. Somebody has figured out that you exist. That somebody was the Church Committee that was investigating CIA abuses.
Headed by Frank Church.
Right. Senator Frank Church was the chairman. So the Church Committee wanted to talk to Gottlieb. This must have shocked him because he lived in total invisibility. And the idea of having to speak about what he had done and appear must have been quite stunning to him. So he did go back to Washington, and he had to testify twice in front of congressional investigators. But he was allowed to do it in a closed room. The questioning was very gentle. The Church Committee was actually not focused on MKUltra. They had other priorities. They were very interested in the assassination plots. And Gottlieb had been involved in those. So they never really penetrated the heart of his mystery. They didn't know the right questions to ask. If they had known what is in my book, Gottlieb would have faced a much harsher cross-examination. But nobody even asked him basic questions like, did you ever conduct experiments outside the United States? Did anybody die as a result of your experiments? So he was able to escape pretty much unscathed and then return to the anonymity in which he felt so comfortable.
Did he spill the beans about what happened in the Congo? In other places?
The story of the Congo had already been told in other documents, and he was actually happy to make it seem like that had been his main job at the CIA, working on projects to kill foreign leaders, which, of course, were authorized at the very highest level. Therefore, he could claim that he had just been following orders. Nobody understood that MKUltra was a much bigger story than that. And that's why it has taken so long to piece this together. In effect, my book is the biography of a guy who did not exist. And that's a difficult biography to write. I put at the very end, maybe one of my favorite lines in the book. It says, everything in this book is true, but not everything that's true is in this book. I'm painfully aware that I've only discovered a piece of what MKUltra was and who Sidney Gottlieb was, but that's plenty.
And this is important to understand because he was the main driver behind MKUltra, unlike the assassination on foreign leaders, in which that was coming orders from above him that wouldn't leave him necessarily responsible for that. MKUltra is a different story. He's driving that program.
You're absolutely right. If Alan Dulles and Richard Helms and Sidney Gottlieb had never existed, there still would have been an MKUltra. But if it hadn't been run by Sidney Gottlieb, I feel it might not have become so extreme, so sadistic, so intense. There might have been a little filter that would make people wonder, isn't there a limit to the amount of evil that you can do in pursuit of a great cause before the evil begins to outweigh the greatness of the cause? Gottlieb never asked himself that and left a lot of victims behind as testimony to his callousness.
And what about the destruction of documents then?
As soon as it became clear in the mid-1970s that Gottlieb had ordered the destruction of all the records of MKUltra, interestingly enough, I found a whole series of documents on this. The FBI became interested because destruction of federal property is a felony. They wanted to prosecute Gottlieb. But after only a few back and forth memos, which I quote in my book, the chief of the FBI, Clarence Kelly, writes that unfortunately we've now figured out that Gottlieb's lawyer, Terry Lenzner, who was a very skilled Washington insider, had secured from the committee that was cross-examining him in private a guarantee of immunity against prosecution for anything that he confessed to. And during his secret testimony, which still has not been revealed, he did say, yes, I destroyed documents. Therefore, having confessed it in this circumstance where he was guaranteed immunity from prosecution, the FBI had to drop its ambition. Now, it turned out that there were some documents left over. at a separate depot, some expense account reports of MK Ultra operatives were found. That allowed us to reconstruct some of these 149 sub-projects that Gottlieb administered. And then a series of other pieces of evidence have come up. So we now have some idea of what he was doing, but it's a frustratingly incomplete one.
What documents do we have? How are you able to put this story together? And there's been others who've written about this,
too. It's true. I'm building on research by others. I'm building on documents that were released from this trove of expense account reports. It turned out that one of Gottlieb's senior agents who worked in San Francisco running a CIA-sponsored bordello kept a diary very indiscreetly.
Bordello? What is a bordello?
So, Gottlieb had an agent in San Francisco hire a string of prostitutes whose job was to bring men into an apartment on Telegraph Hill that he had outfitted and then feed them LSD or other drugs without their knowledge so that this guy working for Gottlieb could sit in the next room, watch through a one-way mirror while sitting on his portable toilet and drinking martinis out of a pitcher.
That's exactly what he did?
It's exactly what he did. And make notes, although he was not trained in any way that would equip him for this, on what the combination of sex and drugs might do to make people more talkative. So this was your tax dollars at work trying to protect America from communism, and this operation was called Operation Midnight Climax. So all of these were part of Gottlieb's effort to find ways to disturb the human mind. And the agent who ran Operation Midnight Climax and was involved in some of the most bizarre MKUltra projects kept this diary, which after his death, his wife donated to a small community college. We were later able to dig that out and find a lot of tidbits. A few victims of Gottlieb's or relatives of victims have now come forward with their stories, and that helps us piece it together. Whitey Bulger, the famous gangster who was found in Santa Monica after hiding for some years there, was a kid in his 20s in a federal prison in Georgia when he was told that he could get some benefits in prison if he participated in an experiment to find a cure for schizophrenia. He never realized until 25 years later that this was actually an LSD experiment sponsored by the CIA. And he was given a substance, which turned out to be LSD, every day for more than a year. And later wrote that this had effects on him that lasted his whole life. And he wrote in great detail the kinds of things that were done to him. He actually told his fellow gangsters in the 70s that he wanted to go back and find that doctor at the prison who was also working at Emory University in Atlanta and kill him. He didn't manage to do that. But that shows you how towards the end of Gottlieb's life, some people slowly picked up on who he was. But even Whitey Bulger never understood that above the doctor who gave him that stuff and above the prison warden was an anonymous person, and that person was named Sidney Gottlieb.
Stephen Ginsberg, you have to forgive me. I'm trying to get past that image of the room on the other side of the window of the toilet and somebody drinking martinis.
Well, it
working
really,
for the, I mean, this was a government program.
Absolutely. And in fact, that guy sitting on the portable toilet drinking martinis also had a day job. He was a federal narcotics agent. So he would spend his evenings using drugs, getting drunk, and poisoning people with drugs. And in the daytime, he was out arresting people who were using drugs.
Wow.
A great character for Sidney Gottlieb. And in the bizarre cast of characters in this book that goes from electroshockers to torturers to Nazi doctors, that agent, George Hunter White, stands out as really one of the most bizarre characters in this book.
George Hunter White. What about you? We're almost out of time here. And in some ways, this is a story that it's interesting, it's almost fun, but obviously it's very dark, too. And the people that this happened to probably wasn't fun at all. They were tortured, killed. What about the accountability for the CIA?
Years later, William Colby, who was then director of the CIA, was asked how the Gottlieb story could have happened, how there could have been these extremes in MK Ultra. And he replied, some of our people were out of control in those days. There were problems of supervision. I think this is a great way for the CIA to handle it. It essentially says it was all Sidney's fault. There's no institutional responsibility, not at the CIA and certainly not at higher levels. So I think the attitude was, let's dump it all on Sidney. And I think the CIA still has that attitude towards him. So in the course of writing this book, I was dealing with the CIA trying to extract various tidbits, and I got the sense that they're not eager to protect Gottlieb. They like the idea that we just made a bad mistake at one point, and some people didn't do the due diligence that they should have done. And I think that has come to be the way that the CIA escaped accountability.
Yeah, that's what you said about Dulles, Alan Dulles before, and it still takes that position.
Absolutely. But the one interesting aspect about the end of Gottlieb's life was that, as I mentioned in my book, it was clear, as testified to by people who knew him in his last years, that he was troubled. He was burdened. Seymour Hersh, who went out to visit him in this period, told me he was a destroyed man. He was racked by guilt. If he'd been a Catholic, he would have gone to a monastery. The rabbi who knew him in that period said that maybe he was just as puzzled in retrospect by what he had done as we were, who began to hear little tidbits of it. So in the end, I think we see Gottlieb as a very contradictory figure. He's an archetype in so many unusual ways. He was a creator who was also a destroyer. He was an outlaw who also served power. He was a gentle-hearted soul who was also a torturer. And that's why I think in the end, his story is a disturbing way for us to understand our country and to understand ourselves.
Stephen Kinzer, thank you.
I can't say it was fun, but it's most interesting.
Stephen Kinzer has been our guest. Stephen Kinzer's latest book, which we've been in conversation about, is called Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control.